Indeed, you might, if you have your Bibles, you might want to open them up to Matthew chapter 18. That's where we'll spend most of our time here, but we'll be looking a lot at other passages around that. As you're getting turned there, I'll just start out by setting the table a little bit here. In Matthew chapter 17, verses 22 and 23, it says, "And while they were gathered together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, 'The Son of Man is going to be delivered in the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day.' And they were deeply grieved." It seems like I get up here periodically and I make the statement that we're in the last days of Jesus setting up his disciples and his men who will be his apostles for the mission before them. And indeed, the whole 3 years was actually that objective, but this is the second time now that Jesus told them plainly what's going to take place. Jesus is beginning to prepare them, these people that will be his most trusted and his most essential disciples, to carry on the work that he intends for them to do. And I'm sure this is cogitating in their minds. I think I invented that word, basically. It's word means working on their minds. It's going to be forming thoughts and trying to figure out just what's going on and what it all means. Among his efforts is a series of object lessons and discourses that will take place, not only in chapter 7, well, the whole Bible, but in our context of our lesson in chapters 17 and 18 and going on into chapter 19. For their benefit to accomplish that, and indeed ours as well. And kind of set the tone, we're looking at Matthew chapter 17, verse 24 through 27. "And when they had come to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, 'Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax?' And he said, 'Yes.' And when he had come into the house, Jesus spoke to him first." I thought it's interesting. He didn't even get a chance to say anything. And Jesus asks him this question: "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or from strangers?" And upon his saying, "From strangers," Jesus said to him, "Consequently, the sons are exempt. But lest we give them offense, go to the sea and throw in a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a stater. Take that and give it to them for you and me." Now, to me, it's very possible that Peter doesn't even really totally understand, as often was the case, what Jesus was actually alluding to here. But basically, they're collecting a poll tax, and he's asking them a question about whether do they collect this from the sons or from strangers. He says, "From strangers." Well, the irony in the whole thing is that Jesus has recently, in my estimation, just gone through the transfiguration where Peter was there, seeing his deity, seeing him before God as the King, and Lord of Lords, and they're receiving a poll tax from the one who is indeed a king. He is of the sons and probably should be exempt from the poll tax. If he's not a king by virtue of his heavenly position, he's certainly a king or in the lineage of the king of David. But he says, "Lest we offend them." Now, it sets the stage for some of the other teachings that are getting ready to come here. So I don't think Peter fully understood it, but again, there's several things as we read through the scriptures that Peter didn't understand, nor would we without the rest of the story. The lesson here is a kind of a righteous humility, to give up the right to be right, even when wronged. Overlooking an offense in an effort to avoid offending someone else in the process. In Matthew chapter 18, this is a continuation. It's a continuation of the lessons that started in chapter 17. In Matthew chapter 18, verse 10, we see Jesus say, "See to it that you don't despise one of these little ones, for I say to you that their angels in heaven continually behold the face of my Father who is in heaven." Now, we'll fill in some of the gaps on why Jesus says this here, but again, the essence of the message that in the conclusion there is don't offend the little children. Don't offend them because, as we will know, as we see later, it's because you should be more like them. So Jesus continues the theme of humility when he calls a small child to himself and tells them that they need to be more like the small child. In fact, he said that that we all have to become more like these children, and we need to be very careful not to cause one of them to stumble. Yet another key word in the passage for us to consider. It's another way of saying we don't want to offend them. They're not to cop an attitude about this one who is supposed to be inferior or supposed to be a nuisance or a problem to them. They have friends in very high places, essentially, is what Jesus is saying, and they have a great deal of influence with those friends in high places. Jesus is expressing that they give careful consideration and recognition to the value of even the least among us as a process of their thinking and the way that they view those around them. Then he continues on in this theme further as he teaches about the value of a single wandering sheep. One that has gone astray in Matthew chapter 18, verse 12. What do you think? I always love when Jesus starts a statement like that. What do you think? It's always a good question. Thinking is a good thing. And he says, what do you think? If any man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountain and go and search for the one that is straying? Now, it's a rhetorical statement because we all know that it's generally understood, of course, that a shepherd is going to inconvenience himself. He's going to humble himself to go after and to seek and save that which was lost, that which was stumbling aimlessly, alone, and exposed to danger. Of course, he's going to do that. And Jesus concludes this point, similar to the previous points, from God's perspective. In Matthew chapter 18, verse 14, where he says, thus it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones perish. So we see that there's an establishment of the value of the lesser, a value of those who are exposed, the value of those who are struggling. So as we get to the passage that's been assigned for our consideration today, I struggle a bit with the often taught moral of the lesson that often comes down to a passage that's being applied only as a means for us, and primarily as a means for us to deal with our personal differences. I want to look at that passage now in Matthew chapter 18, verse 15 through 17. And I'm going to read from the New King James to start. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be to you as a heathen and a tax collector. Interesting to me, this is the first reference to the church in the New Testament, the ecclesia. It's interesting that before it's even really been completely formed, Jesus makes a reference to something, if we can trust the translation, to a body that will exist. It shows us the transition to a new covenant, to a new standard, to a higher and different means by which we interact and act between and amongst. And I believe that that's not by any accident. So first we note here the emphasis on discretion, if possible, and the effort to bring resolution as quickly and quietly as possible, which is not always our natural tendencies. It's an important part of the lesson in the attempt to resolve the matter privately, unless disclosure is absolutely necessary, but the nature of the matter certainly matters. And that's obviously what Jesus is trying to deal with here. Second, there may be, and this is a point that's driven me nuts a little bit, frankly, and it always has, about what may be an unfortunate translation error, or if it's an error at all, that has spun the true intention of this passage to draw us to an incorrect conclusion that I think is worth at least us looking at and understanding. From my research, there appears to be a widespread debate about the inclusion of the phrase "against you" in that passage. It dramatically alters the intent and the focal point of the passage altogether, in my estimation. I've seen through my efforts to bring a resolution in my own mind, it says the earliest and most reliable manuscripts omit the addition of "against you," which I think is interesting, while the later ones, the Byzantine-type manuscripts, include it. Okay? So the fact that it is inserted really changes everything from the focal point of the passage to the attitude of the one who would cite it as an effort to gain some personal restitution. I mean, think about it for a minute. The issue exists right here in this room with regard to the translations. King James and the New King James, they both insert against you. Moreover, if thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell it to him, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. If he will hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. And the translation in New King James is, moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. I happen to be fond of my New American Standard. While it has its problems, it says, if your brother sins, go and prove him in private, and if he listens to you, you have won your brother. A footnote in my New American Standard down there cites that most manuscripts don't contain that insert. Now, the New American Standard doesn't stand as the standard bearer, if you will. Nonetheless, you should know that the first time I read that footnote, it really did confound me, because again, how dramatically that changes from what vantage point one would address the passage. Same thing exists in Luke chapter 17, verse 3, New King James Version. Take heed to yourself. If your brother sins against you, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him. And my New American Standard, be on your guard. If your brother sins, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him. Again, and I've looked at both passages back and forth, and I think that when it comes down to it, I think to myself, okay, well, which is it? Because one makes it a focal point of me, while the other one makes it a focal point of addressing the sin. I think a good question for us to ask ourselves is which one it is, but even more importantly, which one do we prefer it to be? It's important that we try to apply it in context to the rest of the scriptures. Some have speculated that the earlier scribes or translators inserted the "against you" in being influenced by Peter's question later on in Matthew chapter 18, verse 21, where he says, "Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me, and I forgive him?" There's been some inference that perhaps that has driven the consistency of that retranslation in that thought through the rest of the passage. It's my opinion that this question from Peter is yet again another of those very famous questions that Peter would ask, and we're glad he did for our benefit so that we don't have to. He sets the tone and shows us the spirit of man and the things that he says. This chapter 18 started with another one of them in chapter 18, verse 1, where it says, at that time the disciples came to Jesus saying, who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven? That question comes to me out of nowhere because it's a follow-up to the passage we just talked about the Draca and about the paying the poll tax. And Peter's response is, well, who's greatest in the kingdom of heaven then? I don't know where you get there, but that's where the question comes, at least chronologically. And that led Jesus' response in the passage that those who become like those little children, those who are not trying to concern themselves with who's the greatest, but who is in fact the most precious, the most honest, the most valued in God's eyes. A little later in Matthew chapter 19, Peter will ask again a question. And Peter answered, saying to him, behold, we have left everything to follow you. What then will it be for us? And Peter informs that you will have more friends and family and houses, and you will have more than you could possibly imagine and more than you will ever need, is basically Jesus' response to Peter at that point. These are very human and fleshly concerns and questions that focus on ambition and on reward and on preeminence and on those who are positioned within the kingdom of Christ. And we all know the rest of the story, in fairness to Peter, that he will ultimately willingly embrace the call, and he will set aside any of these questions based on the revelations made to him by the Spirit, but his willingness to allow the Spirit to work in him and to accomplish these things. So our passage in Matthew chapter 18, verse 15 is often applied to the notion that one sins against me. And worse, sometimes it's even applied to address offenses that are really only come down to our delicate nature, to be real honest with you. Here in Matthew 18 and verse 20, where Jesus responds to Peter's question about how often will my brother sin against me? Again, that comes back to that passage we said earlier about how often my brother sin against me and I forgive him. Well, Jesus doesn't even really respond back and doesn't say, well, when your brother sins against you, he just responds on how many times you need to forgive him. And he says, how many times? Up to 70 times 7. In my New American Standard, I think 77 is another number, but that's an incredible number of times, is it not? But a lot of times, way more than are practical for us to seek more or for us to even find offense in our brother. So, in other words, kind of forget about that. And then he goes on to teach a parable that's extremely important about a slave who has been forgiven by his Lord for a multitude of debt, and yet was unwilling to forgive his fellow slave for a minor amount, 10,000 talents and 100 drachma or something like that, or denarius or whatever. Doesn't matter. The point to be made there that Jesus is making is that you were unwilling to forgive your brother for your minor infractions while you've been forgiven way more than you could even count, which is essentially what Jesus is saying there. And he concludes in chapter 18, verse 33, should you not also have had compassion on your fellow servant, just as I had pity on you? That's the conclusion to the whole matter right there. Compassion is not justice or restitution. It does not necessarily require a formal confrontation or a personal reckoning, just patient understanding. So I conclude that this passage is not necessarily intended to deal with our personal conflicts between and amongst, although it certainly is the best way to do it privately between two people. But I don't think that it's dealing here with the concept of when I have been offended, to the point that I would ever want to bring it up to the church and bring it up to other people within the church to resolve those kind of matters. And I think it's been used like that for a long time. I think we've pointed to it, and again, there is an element of this that actually is applicable, but the passage itself is really in consideration for the one who is trapped in their condition. It's a conclusion of the previous statement about the Father wishes that none should perish. And the next word is moreover, and it goes into to teach about this. And we'll get more into that as we go on. I may be in the minority here, but I am very hesitant to and even uncomfortable with the notion that others can really ever sin against me in the first place. When I think about that, I think about sin and what it actually is. Certainly there are offenses and slights and unkindnesses and infractions of law or of human decency, but to sin against me in my mind is an overstatement of who and what I am in the first place. What it really comes down to is sin is to miss the mark. Whose mark? It's God's mark. God establishes the mark. Who am I to establish the mark? It is God alone who established that mark, and it is only yours and mine to aim for it and to hit it. The problem is that sometimes when we miss the mark that he has set for us, when we miss, there are often innocent victims of our errant shots, casualties of carelessness, collateral damage, and often unintended roadkill as a process. We're just in the way of the sin that others have, and they've done, and infractions they made towards God. I get this attitude, and I gain this belief from David's inspired words in Psalms 51 and 4. It's always stuck with me. Against thee alone I have sinned and done what is evil in thy sight, so that thou art justified when thou dost speak and blameless when thou dost judge. If it's true that this psalm was written by David after his Bathsheba affair, then it seems to completely set aside the tragic victims of the actions. Uriah, Bathsheba, those who he had implicated in his deadly conspiracy, and even the innocent child that died as a result. He's not addressing that at this point in time. David has violated at least three of God's commandments. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, thou shalt not commit adultery, and thou shalt not kill. And that's what David says against thee and thee alone. Now, have there been victims? There have been a lot of victims. There have been a lot of implications, and there will be a lot of things that David had to deal with, but I think he understood the cause and effect of the lives of those around him, and I'm sure that he had to deal with all those on a different plane than he felt like he needed to deal with the sin before his father. I think the key here is that he needs to address the sin before he can even address the infraction of the sin and the victims of the sin. He has to do that. And I'm sure that there was much to be worked through between him and amongst and all these people for the rest of his life, in his own mind, in the things that he had to deal with. It's a fact that both Testaments teach us the same principles about this kind of a thinking. Is there anybody has anything they want to say? I've got plenty else to say, but Terry.
I understand your sentiment. However, if someone lies to you, is that not a sin against you? If a spouse commits adultery against another spouse, is that not a sin against them?
I think it's an offense against them, but I don't think in the truest sense of what I'm trying to say here, I don't think the attitude that I have about it is that the sin is against God. He says, not to bear false witness. He says, thou shalt not commit adultery. And so that's the violation, and the others are victims of that. There's an infraction there, certainly there is, but I don't think it's a sin against me.
Maybe that's an individual perspective.
But that's exactly what you're free to carry it.
Well, I just have to take the word at face value. It says if a brother sins against you, then that's
right.
Me.
Right.
So, and that's the words of Jesus. Sure. I think the more important principles.
If that's not an insertion that doesn't belong in my Bible, it doesn't say against you. That was my point exactly. What translation is reliable?
Well, again, I just take it at face value. I think the more important principle is go, whether it's an offense or a sin, is to go and confront the brother. I think that's more the important principle that we should maybe focus on.
I tend to get there as well. I have a difficult time to say that somebody sins against me when I'm not the author of what sin is. I can be a victim of it. You could be a victim, have been, perhaps. The other element of this is the level of what we determine in our minds to be sin against us that often is not sin at all. And that's kind of, I struggle with allowing this passage to be used for us to deal with this when we've had our feelings hurt. That's part of the line I'm trying to be careful with here. Because I believe there's other principles to work.
Steve, could you read the 15th and 16th verse from the ASV?
I don't have ASV. I don't have ASV.
ASV?
I don't have it.
What are you coming reading from?
The New American Standard.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. I don't have it.
I thought you said ASV.
So. No. Sorry. It translates what? Unto thee? It has the translation against thee?
Against thee. Yeah. So if you take that out on your translation, yeah. how does the 16th verse read? Because that seems to be against someone personally as well, too.
I'll have to go get it. I don't think I wrote it.
Okay.
Yeah, I do. I'm sorry. Hang on a minute.
Hang on a second.
Who has New American Standard? Anybody?
I have it here just a minute.
Thank you. 16. But if you will not hear you, take with you one or two more, and by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. It's basically saying take whatever the issue or the sin is, and it doesn't say against me. Certainly doesn't say against me. Again, I share with you only that it is important for each of us to deal with. I'm trying to share with you what I'm trying in my mind to get to the most consistent view, what I think the scriptures say with regard to how to deal with sin and what our attitude should be about what we're getting resolved. And it's not our restitution as much as it is the restoration of the one who has sinned. And so, again, I hope to get to it if we get there finally.
I'll try to be quick because I think you're trying to move on, but I tend to agree with you. In the earliest versions of the Greek manuscripts, that phrase is not there. That's it, right? Shows up later.
It does.
And so then, you know, you kind of get into this, well,
do
we have all that? And I don't want to go down that road.
I don't.
But I do think that even without that, right, you don't want to, like, go up to everybody anytime they make a mistake, right?
Right.
Or because, you know, these different things. I mean, you're not supposed to cause your brother to stumble, I think, is kind of the bigger picture of how can we handle disagreements, or even if your feelings do get hurt, handle that in a way that's between that individual and not publicly and not creating divisions, I think, is more the large picture.
I agree. So, if we can carry on here, there's one passage that in the Old Testament that kind of sticks out is basically something with, I'm thinking about in terms of the victims now, where it says, "You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people. You shall love your brother as yourself. I am the Lord." And so, again, we can point to several passages in the New Testament to get the same thing, but I'm trying to get our minds around the idea of bearing the grudge and of finding ourselves dealing. Certainly there's infractions that need to be dealt with. I get it. But even after you've addressed them with somebody, there's still the issue of dealing with the grudge, dealing with bearing with letting these things go. It doesn't remove the fact that there have been injuries or violations or painful experiences that need to be dealt with. It just means that it's often ours to work out between and amongst, and it means that we have to maybe work them out internally. time and an earnest desire to love our brothers as ourselves is a big component of resolving these issues and moving on. There are no cases that I think that truly to offend that, you know, that a truly offensive act is, does not come back to some element of sin back towards God. That's what I'm kind of saying. That's got to be thought through and dealt with. And our attitude about the one who is offending is extremely important here. When we look at the difference between perhaps sinning and offenses, I'm thinking in terms now, we're still in chapter 18 of Matthew. To offend is to trip up or to stumble or to entice to sin. And that word is used in the New King, in the King James Version in Matthew chapter 18, verse 8 and 9, which is translated causes you to stumble or causes you to sin in the New American Standard and in the King James one, causes you to sin in the New King James and stumble in the New American Standard. And it says, if your hand or foot offends you, cut it off and cast it from you. Better to enter life lame or maimed. And then it goes on in verse 9 to say, if your eye offends you, causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. To date, I have yet to see anyone so personally offended by their own feet and hand and eyes that they would take a hatchet or a melon scoop to themselves to remove that influence from them. Because, again, this is probably the same hyperbole that we see in Christ saying about things like hating your parents and everything else. It's a relative nature to dealing with the underlying sin, to dealing with it. And the same kind of offenses are those things that could be brought upon us by somebody else. It's very possible that a brother's sinful behavior justifies the removal to protect the body, the ecclesia, from the sinful influence, but it should be considered as serious as taking that hatchet or melon scoop to our own body to remove that influence or from ourselves. And there's passages in Scripture. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 says, Paul writes to the church there, you got immorality among you. You got to get it out, and they do. But when he repents of it, they said you got to restore your love for him and reaffirm your love is the word that's used there, and bring him back in. So it's not a matter of cutting something off that can never be put back together, but it's a matter of the issues to keep one among the brethren, to bear with the offense to the degree that one must, and to remove the offending element if it can't be reconciled through what we see in the rest of that passage there in Matthew chapter 18. It's not about getting retribution or restitution or satisfaction for some righteous indignation or justice for some petty oversight or offense or some habitual clumsiness on the part of another person or their careless or thoughtless oversights. It's an intent to prevent, if possible, the traumatic surgical process of removing a brother from the body and keeping him removed from the body. It's, I think, in essence of the passage, it's important for us to try to get to the place where we don't internalize these things to make them personal, to let the personal issues going on be brought to the same place that we would bring sinful behavior that needed to be dealt with in the church. I would never want to escalate a personal matter to the point of mediation with others involved, or certainly not to a tribunal place where I would want their fellowship challenged. I would prefer to see that worked out and for me to work it out. Without getting to that place. It only makes sense to me where cases where sin just can't be tolerated that we find ourselves in a place where we would ever want to go down that road. While I may struggle with feelings of distaste or animosity towards a brother, I am unable to just justify any claims to call them my enemy, or to desire their spiritual demise over our petty differences. And that's where I'm trying to make sure we draw the line. There are so many scriptures that teach us patience and tolerance and forbearance, so it's difficult for me to justify any form of restitution simply for my hard feelings when Jesus teaches us exactly the opposite in so many different ways. Again, is it hyperbole? I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. If anyone compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him and ask you and from whom he wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. It's a high bar, and it's not one that we often try to hurdle in all cases, that's for sure. There's a principle that I've tried to apply that I certainly have not mastered. But I think about what Paul taught in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, where he has just scolded the Corinthians for, among other things, taking each other to court to seek justice and restitution. This passage here is not too different than what Jesus taught in Sermon on the Mount with regard to dealing with your opponent on the way to court, essentially. But after shaming them for this practice, he makes a statement I think would serve us all well to heed and to embrace. He says in verse 6, "Now therefore, it is already an utter failure for you that you go to law against one another. Why do you not rather accept wrong? Why do you not rather let yourself be defrauded?" It's always stuck with me. Why not rather take the high road and just do what you can to let it go, to take your lumps and deal with it for the sake of the other brother? And I think it's Matthew chapter 5, verse 39, where he says, "Make peace with your opponent on the way, lest you have," in other words, now I think you're the offender in the final day. Make peace as the offender and look not to be offended on the other side, and makes for a more peaceful resolution. Better to be wronged or mistreated or abused or insulted or slighted or maligned than to see your brother or sister go before the judge. And I think that's really the ultimate example of compassion that Jesus was trying to teach there. Romans chapter 12, verse 17 through 19, in that passage, it says, "Much depends on you. Live peaceably with all men. Do not avenge yourself," back to the point of Leviticus chapter 19, "do not avenge yourself, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord." So again, same concept on this side of the cross, if you will, the same issues for us to do our best not to look for our pound of flesh. With regard to our own sense of justice, our own sense of being made right or held whole, or to receive our personal well-deserved apology, best often just to let it go. Why? Because Ephesians chapter 4, verse 31 and 32 tell us to let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you, and all malice, and be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, just as God in Christ has forgiven you. The idea being that that we didn't come to the Father with every one of our infractions and ask him. We expect it. So why not give up this few things we hang on to for the sake of the brother? I think that his teaching is to take a high ground on humility and compassion with actions that consider the condition of the weaker and the lesser and the more vulnerable. and their motives and our motives to be consistent with the lessons we've seen there. One last thought here. I think we're at, how many do I got here? 30 seconds? Three. Okay, well, can you imagine Galatians chapter 3, I'm sorry, 6, verse 1 through 3. Brethren, if any man is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness, each one looking to himself, lest he too be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and thus fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks he is something, he is nothing. He deceives himself. Imagine if that passage had against you inserted into it. Brethren, if any man is caught in any trespass against you, you who are spiritual. Does that even make sense? Is that the example that Christ gave? To have to be, to have to receive his just restitution before he would forgive. It was as if he never made himself the focus, guess what I'm saying? Never did. Never looked for his own sense of justice, and he never got it. Anyway, I leave it with you. Thanks for your time and attention this morning.